Hello, I'm Michael Dunn, and this is the Oregon Rainmakers podcast on KLCC. My guest today is Bev Smith, legendary basketball player and coach at the U of O and the executive director of Kids Sports. 2022 is the 50th anniversary of Title IX, and we're going to talk about her career, that historic ruling, and the importance of kids sports and sports in general for girls and boys. Welcome.
Thank you, Michael. It's great to be here.
I really appreciate you coming in. So tell me, take us back. Where'd you grow up? How'd you get interested in sports and basketball and kind of, that launching pad for where you are today?
Well, it was a long time ago, but it was a very important time of my life, certainly. I grew up in Salmon Arm, British Columbia, which is in Canada, about a 12-hour car ride from Eugene, Oregon, and we lived on the Trans-Canada Highway. So if you've ever driven from Vancouver to Calgary, BC, through British Columbia, through to Alberta, you've gone through Salmon Arm.
Okay.
And I grew up there. I was born in Armstrong, British Columbia. My father and mother started there, and my dad was a former hockey player, played in junior hockey in Canada back in the day, and went on to play a couple of games professionally, and then had to sort of reroute his career to join the Navy for World War II.
Okay.
And so really growing up, I'm the third of four children, two boys and two girls. Our parents were very active. We were active. We had to go outside. My mom didn't want four of us hanging around the house. So, Saturdays and Sundays, we had to find our own sort of sandlot games. And we did. We played a lot. There wasn't a lot of organized sports back then in elementary school. And so we grew up swimming in the summertime. There's lots of water in Canada in the form of lakes. And swimming in the summertime with our parents at various beaches. We grew up in what is called the Shuswap Lake. It's got about 1,000 miles of coastline, so a lot of places to kind of jump in the water and learn about swimming.
Sure.
And with three siblings, we learned a lot about being competitive, both at the dinner table and certainly in sports. And my mom and dad were very active in the community. My dad did a lot of hockey stuff. He played hockey. He coached hockey, officiated hockey. My mom was a teacher that liked to teach young kids to skate. She was a stay-at-home mom, but really volunteered throughout the community. And so we spent a lot of times in the summer on the lake, and in the winter we were either at the skating rink and the ice rink, or we were in the curling rink. They were avid curlers, and so we spent a lot of time just being active. And I think that I often say at Kids Sports, healthy, active kids become healthy, active adults, and my three siblings are still very much physically active in their lives.
That's great. That's great. So what was your sort of first introduction to playing basketball?
Well, basketball became a secondary option for me. I really wanted to play hockey. I thought I was going to be the first female to ever play for the Montreal Canadiens. And I played hockey with my brother. He was 13 months younger than I was, so we were the best of friends and the worst of enemies. But we played on the pond. We skated down to our pond from our house, skated all day, and then kind of skated back on the roads. And I just really loved the game. I loved playing it. I thought it was an excellent way just to have teammates and be a part of something bigger than yourselves. But at that time, in the early 1960s, there was no minor hockey for girls.
Okay.
I tried to find a place to play with some women, older women that played in the community, but our ice time was about midnight to 1 o'clock. And I snuck out one night, and that didn't go too well with my mother. And so she said, you need to find a more ladylike sport to follow. And I did that. My sister started playing basketball in junior high. She was about 6 feet when she was in eighth or ninth grade and was a lefty and seemed to be not liking sports at all. And the junior high coach, who was a good friend of my dad, said, how do we get her to play? And so she started playing. I went to watch her practices, and I fell in love with the game because it was an opportunity for me to pursue something that had a future.
Yeah. I can imagine when you were a little girl, fast forward now, and it seems like, again, not on parity, but, women being able to play hockey at the collegiate level and at the Olympic level must be much larger of an opportunity than what you saw back then, even though I know Canada is hockey crazy, of course.
Oh, I'm so envious. I'm so envious of our national team and just the number of gold medals that they have won. And I am also just jealous and envious of our Canadian athletes who go to the States and play NC2A,
yeah.
You know, hockey. And so there's the Frozen Four instead yeah. of the Final Four.
Yeah.
And I, you know, as much as I'm envious of that, I'm so greatly appreciative of the fact that young women do have a chance to play hockey, because it is a great sport. My dad loved it. I loved it. Didn't get a chance to play it, but now I revel in the opportunity that so many young girls and women get that opportunity and represent their nations, their universities, their high schools in such a great way.
Sure. So just between us, if oftentimes the, you know, the NBA playoffs and the NHL, the Stanley Cup finals are kind of overlap. What would you choose to watch if you could?
Well, you know, my heart has waned with the game of hockey just okay. because I'm not living in
sure,
it every
sure.
single day.
Sure.
My brothers always call me up and say, did you see the Canucks, what they've
yeah.
done? Or,
yeah.
hey, did you see your old Canadians, what they've done? And I have to tell them, no, unfortunately, my sporting heart has sort of moved on to, you know, basketball because
sure.
I coached it at a high level.
Sure.
It tends to get my attention more so. Particularly when I was coaching, I can say now that I probably watch more third and fourth grade soccer, baseball, softball, basketball games than I do anything.
Sure,
and to
sure.
me, that is living. But my heart sort of had to veer and follow the game of basketball. But I truly loved them when I was in those elements and in those years.
When you started playing basketball competitively, I have had the fortune to talk to athletes at various levels, and there often was sort of an aha moment where they realized, wow, I really can play this game, and I think I have a future beyond junior high school or even high school. Did you have a moment like that?
You know, I think the moment for me was I was 16 and we were watching the Montreal Olympics, which were, you know, pretty yeah. big for Canada
sure,
to host
sure,
the
absolutely.
Summer Olympics. And it was the first time women's basketball had a competitive opportunity to play at the Olympics. And we had a Canadian women's national team that was involved in the Olympics. And we had, you know, to my great happiness, one of the women that grew up with the Salmon Arm Jewels, which is a storied high school girls basketball program in our province. Joanne Sargent played on that team.
Okay, yeah.
And Joanne, I watched play. I watched her practice. She was only 5'4", and I think she held the assist record at the Olympics until, I believe, around 1996 when Teresa Edwards
wow.
broke it. So she was prolific. And
yeah.
I looked at her and thought, wow, you know, she can do it. I think that I have a chance to maybe make it. And that summer, I had a couple of the national team program members reach out to see if I would go and try out for the Olympic team. And I think my parents kind of kiboshed it just because of how young I was.
Okay.
And I was disappointed that that wouldn't happen. But just having them have that interest thrown my way, I think really catalyzed and galvanized all of what I was putting into the game at that time. I still played three sports in high school
wow.
despite that, because we had to back then. You know, I had to have the volleyball team because
sure.
they didn't have enough numbers. I had to play field hockey because our basketball coach said it was the best way to condition for basketball.
Sure.
But I really sort of started working out in the morning with basketball because I felt I really had a chance to. I didn't know. Nothing was promised. Nothing was guaranteed. But in the competitions and in the subsequent tryouts I had for the national teams, I made the junior national team when I was 17 and then the national team when I was 18. And really, I hadn't refined my game. I could run, I could rebound, and I could play defense. And so those three things got me to the national team and actually had me starting my first year.
Wow.
And I thought I had, you know, I had found utopia.
Before I ask you how you got to the U of O, one thing you just said about a multiple sport experience, being able to play multiple sports, it seemed like, I don't know, 5 to 10 years ago, there was this real push of like specialization for young athletes. Just play one sport and keep repeating it over and over again to develop that muscle menu. And that seems to be kind of on the way out. And it seems like a lot of people are talking about playing multiple sports
is really good for overall development because it there's muscle memory differences, but also it just provides more of a variety. Do you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. I wouldn't be half the basketball player I eventually ended up being without playing hockey, without
sure.
playing volleyball, without playing soccer, without playing field hockey, without playing
sure.
sandlot games, and quite frankly, without having physical education. I was from the era where we had physical education for every single day.
Sure.
And that taught us as much as anything in terms of not just physiologically and physically and learning the fundamental movement and motor skill development, but it also taught us early on how to win, how to lose, how to self-regulate. And certainly sports specialization has come into a little bit of a microscope because we have had that over the last 20 years. You need to play basketball, or if you want to be the next Mia Hamm, you have to play soccer all year round.
Yeah.
I don't believe that's true. I think there's a lot of six-year-olds that do play soccer all year round. If you look at how many kids from middle school make the high school team, it's about 2%.
Yeah.
When you look at how many high school students go on to play at Division I, Division II, or Division III college programs in soccer, basketball, whatever the sport may be, it's maybe 1%, and then who goes on to professional. So, the statistics show that. You don't want to ever cut anybody's dream, but
sure.
I think if you think of it as a learning opportunity, sport is no different than school. So I'll have parents ask me, Bev, I've been told by coaches, and my daughter feels the same way, that she could be the next Mia Hamm, and she's 6 years old. She wants to play basketball or soccer all year round.
Sure.
And I said, yeah, I understand that. I said, so let's compare it to school. So if your third grade teacher came to you and said your daughter at six is going to be the next J.K. Rowling,
okay.
and she should only write.
Mm.
She shouldn't study math. She shouldn't study socials. She shouldn't social studies or history or science. She should just write for the rest of her life. What would you say?
Yeah.
And they say, well, I don't know if that's right, right? And so the costs, so sort of the plus and minuses, the pros and the cons of specialization versus non-specialization are, yes, your child could go on to do that, but there's risk of injury, there's risk of burnout, there's risk of them not being that worldly global writer
sure.
and taking all of those subjects
sure.
that she would if she would miss out on. And it's the same when you play a sport all year round. You have overuse injuries, you have psychological burnout,
yep.
you kind of plateau in different ways. You could be an earlier mature and be great in third and fourth grade, and then you go through puberty and you don't grow anymore, you don't get faster anymore. And then you have someone like me who was a little bit of a Saint Bernard when I was in third and fourth and fifth grade, just kind of lumbering along. And my teachers and my coaches stayed with me. And when I went through puberty, I discovered that because of all of that sort of non-sport specific experience that I had really developed me in ways that it wouldn't have had I just chosen one sport. So my thought for parents is just really try to get as much information as you can and make an informed decision rather than maybe just feeling the pressure of the friends of your child or the coach telling you this. Do some research yourself to see what are the plus and minuses and what are the costs and consequences of that.
Indeed. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about when you got to the U of O and maybe talk about sort of when you looked out on the horizon and said, I think I could coach this game. We'll be right back. We're talking with Bev Smith, the executive director of Kids Sports. We'll be back.
Each day you tune into KLCC to learn and be inspired. Together, KLCC and our listener members keep our communities informed with high-quality journalism. Support public radio and make a gift at klcc.org. Everyone who contributes by noon on Friday, September 23rd, will be placed in a drawing for a pair of tickets to Hamilton at the Holt Center on Sunday, September 25th. Learn more at klcc.org.
And we're back. We're talking with Bev Smith, the executive director of Kids Sports. So, obviously, you grew into your potential. You came to the U of O to play basketball. Talk about that. Talk about kind of what that experience was like, and sort of take us through, because the game has changed since you played, and kind of talk a little bit about sort of how you've had a front row seat of how the women's game in college has evolved.
Yes. So certainly, you know, it was a big decision for me to leave the country of Canada and come here to the United States to go to university. And there was a number of really positive factors that I looked at. First of all, at 18, as a high school player, I was playing on our national team. And so, you know, I was really good, but as I mentioned, it was more physical than it was technical. And so there's a couple of things that in my young mind, I was thinking, first of all, I was offered a full ride scholarship because of the legislation of Title IX that happened in 1972. So by 1978, there were some scholarships available here at the University of Oregon. So that was big for our family.
Sure.
Our family wasn't well off. And so I had a chance to go to university. The second thing was my sister was here. She played basketball in high school, went to the University of British Columbia for the for 2 years. It was overwhelming for her. It was a 41,000 student campus.
Wow.
And so just from coming from a little place called Salmon Arm, she she played on the basketball team. She enjoyed it, but it was just too much. So some personal friends and family friends had come down to the University of Oregon to take part in the physical education program at the university that was one of the best in the world to get their degree and their master's in physical education. And so our friend coached basketball. He walked into the basketball office his first year here, said, I can help, got a job as an assistant coach, and then they recruited my sister to play. And one of the possibilities was my sister was 4 years older than I was, but if she had been out for 2 years, so if I came to the University of Oregon scholarship, my sister gets to play with me for the first time ever because we were so far apart, but because she had a couple of times where she didn't, 2 years she didn't play. And the last thing was I just looked at the level of competition that I would have coming at me in the United States, and that was a little bit more than the competition that we had in Canada. The coaching in Canada was as good as I could get, I think, anywhere in the world. Mm. It's just I felt that the competition might be a little bit less than I needed really to enhance my skills as an 18-year-old already playing on the national team. So I took that as a challenge, and it really did work out for me. It was probably one of the best decisions I made in my life, not just athletically, but academically. I got an outstanding education here at the University of Oregon and really learned a lot in those two areas and learned a lot about myself.
Sure. Well, and you got a lot from the University of Oregon, but you obviously gave a lot too. You were an outstanding player. And then, you know, so how long was it after you stopped playing that you thought, hey, coaching could be something that is part of my next trajectory?
Well, I always felt like I was a bit of a coach on the floor as a player. A lot of coaches would mention that to me, kind of like, if you don't know what that means, think of Sabrina Ionesco and what she did on the floor and how she led and how she coached and how it really was, you know, a lot of her sort of leadership that helped that team be successful. And so in my time, that's really where I felt I brought a lot of value to our teams. And when I was here at Oregon and when I was playing internationally, so when I graduated from Oregon in 1982, there was no professional league.
Sure.
And playing on the national team in Canada, I got to know some players in the Italian national team who said, we have a domestic league that allows one foreigner per team to come and play. And so I was recruited by a team in Italy, and I went over there to play professionally. And while I was over there, you know, I was a professional. I practiced in the afternoon. I didn't really have anything to do in the morning. It was hard to get in the gym. And then I figured out if I brought a bottle of wine to the gym, to the guy that could open the gym, he did that so I could work out. But in the afternoon, I started coaching the younger players in my club and really enjoyed it.
Wow.
And so I always felt that I was a little bit of a coach, even while I was playing. And I always went back to my high school and ran a summer basketball club called Hoops Are Hot in the Shoe Swap, and you know, sort of provided that money to my high school team as a way of giving back. So there's a little bit of coaching in me. So
sure.
I played overseas until 1996.
Okay.
Played with our national team until 1996 and retired after the 96 Olympics in Atlanta. And actually became a coach for my old club team back in Italy.
Okay.
From 96 to 97, and then was recruited by a Division I team over there to coach until 2000. Coached the national team in Canada for the 2000 Olympics in Sydney. And so I felt that that really would be a career for me. And then applied for the job at the University of Oregon, was able to coach at my alma mater, which was an incredible honor.
Sure.
To try and bring young women into this university that had so much of an impact on my life. So it kind of was a natural evolvement.
Sure.
From player to player coach to coach.
Sure. It's interesting, and in learning about your career and learning about women's professional basketball, playing overseas, at the time there wasn't a professional league here in the States. And it's still interesting because I know that, and I learned this fairly late, in that a lot of the WNBA players now, they need to play overseas because they're not making nearly as much money as the men do. And so there are a lot of alternatives for them to go play overseas, as opposed to not that many opportunities to make really good money here in the United States. But so you went overseas and had to kind of see that whole kind of evolution, you know, to some degree firsthand.
Yeah. So, I think I was maybe in 1983, I was probably the second year of foreigners playing in their league.
Okay.
And so it was novel.
Yeah.
And you felt very, very honored because there was only one foreigner per team.
Sure.
So you had to be really, really on top of your game to get that contract. And
sure.
It was, I think my first year over there, I made $26,000, which was sort of, comparative to a first year's teacher salary.
Sure, sure, sure.
So
sure.
I felt like I was in basketball heaven. I was a professional. I
yeah.
had an apartment. I had a car. I was playing with great players in Italy, playing against other teams that had, Americans. Carol Mencken, who I fought years against, she was a Beaver. She was over there playing
okay.
in Italy, and we went from arch rival enemies to great friends because she could make chocolate chip cookies over there, which I needed. But yes, I saw that evolve. It became something that we did because there was no professional league here.
Yeah.
And I think it's not only, I think the salaries in the WNBA have improved.
Yeah.
But I also think the WNBA season goes from May till August. And so that's 3 or 4 months. You have 8 months of how do you keep your game sharp? How do
sure.
you keep on top of that game?
Sure.
And so Europe, I think, and China, and there's opportunities in Japan and Australia, not only provide you with some income that really helps you to make a career out of it and pay your bills, but it also gives you another venue to keep your game
sure.
sharp until you get back to the WNBA. And there's players, quite honestly, that I don't know how they do it. Sue Bird, Diana Taurasi, some of the Australians who play all summer, then they play all winter in their leagues, and then they play in the national team.
Yeah, I know.
So, my hat goes off to them, and
yeah.
I think people are really only understanding the European opportunity also through the, unfortunate Brittany Griner episode that we're still currently managing.
Sure. For people who don't know, Brittany Griner, amazing player and certainly one of the stars of the WNBA for a decade or so, but she was playing in Russia. She was, that was her professional team when she was there. So no, it's a very sad story, but also it's indicative of what needs to happen in order to sort of get that pay parity. And we've seen that too. What was it? It was a University of Oregon player who brought up the disparity in facilities mm-hmm. during the NCAA tournament between the men who had this warehouse full of weight facilities and the women's teams had like a stack of dumbbells. And so a lot of progress has been made, but a lot of progress still needs to be made.
Well, it does, and I think it takes student athletes like Sedona to expose that and to
yeah.
say, look at, we're not complaining, but we are student athletes. We work just as hard. We're just
sure.
as competitive. We want to win just as badly. We want to be prepared. There's no reason that it shouldn't be that way, particularly since 1972. That's
yeah.
50 years
exactly.
ago.
Exactly.
I mean, if we had a highway regulation that still wasn't being complied with, I
yeah.
think there'd be a lot more
yeah.
disdain. And
yeah.
and so while we have come a long way, I mean, I go on ESPN and I still have to click on other sports to get to the WNBA. That
yeah.
just drives
yeah.
me crazy because we have NASCAR. We have, not to dismiss NASCAR, but
sure.
I really feel that the population in the United States is probably 50-50, in
yep.
terms of who is living here. And we need to have access that relates to what our women are trying to do. And so you can't, you know, you can't thank the women that are still pushing that needle, because it takes a lot of energy.
Absolutely.
And you can just get by and get your career done, but there's women like, you know, the soccer player Rapinoe, who's really, you know, youth. It's not easy to go and testify in front of Congress. It's not easy, because with social media now, you know who the haters are out
yeah,
there.
You do.
So you have to be above all that. And I think that they understand that the fight needs to continue, just to make sure that there's parity. I think Title IX, what it did is gave people a chance. It gave me a chance to be a student athlete. But on the other side of Title IX, what also happened was in 1972, 7% of medical degrees were women. 9% of legal law degrees were women. In 2022, 50% of law degrees are going to women, 51% of medical degrees. So Title IX was access to education, not to athletics, to education. And I really believe that athletics and sports, it should be co-curricular, because of the values we just talked about that it brings to a person and a student athlete.
Absolutely, absolutely. We're going to take our next break. We're talking with Bev Smith. We're going to get into kids sports and how important that is in our community, and providing those opportunities for both boys and girls to grow and to thrive. We'll be back in just a second.
I'm Barbara Dellenbach, host of KLCC's Oregon Grapevine. Gary Tepfer is a well-known photographer, musician, and creative thinker. He notes that photographers are a special group.
A photographer has to go out into the weather when it's bad rather than get in the tent. They might have to be on top of a mountain when it's dark. It's just a different pace. It's not a comfortable pace for most people to be out in. And so it is a pretty solitary pursuit.
Gary talks about his love of Eugene and his professional life on the newest Oregon Grapevine at klcc.org.
And we're back. We are talking with Bev Smith of Kids Sports. And let's talk about that. This podcast, we focused a lot on parity in sports, and we've talked a lot about the necessary changes that have to be made. And certainly in your lifetime, you've seen when you were a child, not as many opportunities to now where it's getting better, still not all the way there, but getting better. But certainly foundational to all that is just the opportunity for boys and girls to play sports. And that's obviously kids sports, you know, one of its primary missions. So talk about kids sports, when you stopped coaching and how you got to kids sports, and take us through a pretty storied history of what kids sports has meant for Eugene.
Yes. Kids sports has been in the community for, you know, almost 70 years.
Yeah.
1954, it began as the Eugene Boys Athletic Association with a little bit of basketball, and then it kind of added some baseball. And it really was the founding mothers and fathers were ahead of their time, I think. They wanted an organization, number one, where all kids could play. So that meant, regardless of your ability,
yeah,
we got to find you a way to get on the field or on the floor. And secondly, regardless of your ability to pay, we need to find a scholarship program, because all kids need that opportunity.
Sure.
And it's not necessarily just to play sports so you can win the third grade championships. It's about being with a group with sort of physical, physiological, and now the big buzzword is social emotional development. And yeah, it really is about that. And learning to be a good teammate, learning to work hard, learning how to manage winning and losing and disappointment and success. It really does allow children to discover themselves. And I might make a caveat here that it has to be done correctly with a quality coach that,
sure,
understands what's important in youth sports. But it, you know, it began in 1954. It then morphed in 1972 to the Eugene Sports Programs, because mothers and fathers said, my goodness gracious, if this is good for our boys, it has to be good for our girls.
Sure.
And so it became the Eugene Sports Program in 1972. And then it started to go out to Springfield and provide opportunities for families in Springfield. And so also go out of district to Cottage Grove, Junction City, Harrisburg. We have teams from Roseburg and Coos Bay,
yeah,
in some of our programs. So then in the late 90s, it became Kid Sports, so all-encompassing In terms of geography and demographics as well. And I was let go by the University of Oregon in 2009 from the coaching position. And I really liked coaching, but I really liked Eugene, Oregon.
Yeah.
And I felt at that time in my life, I really wanted to be in a place that I liked, and I really enjoy this community. So I had known of kids sports. I had done some clinics as a basketball coach, and it was fortunate that Chris Miller, who was the previous executive director, a former Duck football player and professional football player, was leaving at that time. And so I applied for the job and got the job. And it was kind of like, maybe I'll try to get off the hamster wheel of just being in the world of basketball. I've kind of seen it all. And so, devoted my time and energy and passion, because I'm very passionate about youth sports and what it can provide for children because of my experience.
Sure.
And so it just, the board asked me, is this just going to be a 1-year deal, 2-year deal until you find another coaching gig? And I said, well, if you're still interested in all kids play, I will commit to 3 years of doing this. And they didn't answer me, but they hired me. So here we are 13 years later.
And in that time, not only have you increased, the number of kids who participate, but you've also been instrumental in helping to sort of move kids sports to the wonderful refurbished, Civic and stuff. Talk about that, because obviously, in addition to having kids and quality coaches, having quality facilities is a big part of being able to help kids realize their potential through sports.
Absolutely. The space that we have is limited here in Eugene. We do have great partnership with all three of our school districts. We could not possibly deliver these programs without their assistance. And they do it on a very minimal cost to us because we're a 501c3. We have volunteer coaches. We provide scholarships, and we don't cut kids.
Yeah.
They have user guidelines that allows us then to use those facilities for $5 per registrant. And so that registration fee that families pay, we send $5 to the school district. It's a very minimal charge, but the school districts realize we do provide a co-curricular activity, that being active is important, being with a team is important, being with a quality coach really just enhances all that the teachers do in school if we do it correctly. So I really believe it's co-curricular. I think there are things that you can learn on the field and on the courts of play that you don't necessarily learn in the classroom when you're sedentary. And I think it enhances. And when you're physically active and physiologically your metabolism is going, you also are going to get a cognitive advantage because the happy hormones kick in and your brain is flooded with dopamine and serotonin. And now you develop areas of the brain that you wouldn't necessarily if you didn't have that 60 minutes of vigorous to moderate exercise a day, which is what the CDC recommends.
Sure.
And with a lack of physical education now, I think after school activities and sports are really important. And I was maybe my third or fourth year as the executive director of kids sports, and I really felt with sort of school closures and budget cuts and janitorial hours being shortened, we wouldn't have enough time, to really deliver those programs. So I really felt we needed to have a space and a place of our own. And fortunately, I was able to join the Eugene Civic Alliance, which is an outstanding nonprofit formed deliberately to buy and then to build out Civic Park with the Kids Sports Fieldhouse. And so we got on our horses and we raced down the track to raise $30 million for the build out. This community was absolutely incredibly generous, and we were able to, within a span of 4 or 5 years, build this incredible facility, both indoor and outdoor space, that we opened in the middle of the pandemic, which was both fortunate and unfortunate at the same time. But we were really able to help our community during that critical time of kids being locked in their houses. We were able to run summer camps and activities, not necessarily our core sports, but able to maybe offer a little bit of a normalized childhood to our community during those really trying times.
Well, it's interesting, and as we kind of wrap up here, kids sports saw a need and fulfilled it. And obviously, I imagine Do you ever get the opportunity? Do you visit other communities that maybe are seeing a real crunch and they're losing sports? And is kids sports exportable that other communities could kind of learn the model and perhaps be able to copy what you've done here to be able to keep sports alive for their youth?
Really interesting question and timely one, because I haven't been able to go out to other cities and regions, but people have been reaching out to me.
Okay.
How do you do this?
Sure.
How can we blueprint this? What is it that happens? And I at times I think that this organization is very unique to Eugene.
Yeah.
We have 1,400 volunteer coaches.
Wow.
And I really have to, every time I get the chance, to thank them for their energy, their expertise, their time, their consideration, their effort, their care and consideration of kids, because we could not possibly do it, even if we had thousands of
sure.
square footage of facilities, without our volunteer coaches. It's just, it gives me goosebumps every time I think about it, every time I go to a meeting with them, every time I see them out on the fields of play. But many people are coming to us and saying, how do you do this? Because they recognize the value of all kids playing,
sure.
developing, and having fun. And with our new space, we're able to do more activities. We do Fit Kid activities for 18-month to 3-year-olds to come in and get that entry level of motor and movement skill development. We have a PE Fusion class we offer all year round. We do many different things that we can, because we can access that space and place. And we also do adult
yeah.
activities. And so it's really been an opportunity for us to share the mission of kids sports with a greater population and a greater sort of bandwidth of kids. I mean, we never thought we could help 18-month-year-olds learn how to move their bodies and help parents understand that youth sports highway that's going to come at you, and how do you navigate it, so we can help with that information as well. And so it's just been an honor and privilege for me to help grow this program that I think really understands and does what's best for children, not for the win-loss column, not for the revenue column, or the profit and loss margin, although that's important. I think we do everything based on what's best for kids.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Bev, this is great. I really enjoy talking to you, and you've done so much for this community, and it's obviously, you know, you've kind of put your stamp on the incredible importance of what sports and just movement can do for an individual child as well as the entire community.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Michael. Great questions.
Thanks.
Great.
Thanks so much. Well, that was our conversation with Bev Smith, Executive Director of Kids Sports. Boy, so much has happened in sports for girls over the decades, and Bev has been right there in the middle of that progress. This has been Oregon Rainmakers Podcast. I'm Michael Dunn, your host. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.